I do not believe I ever experienced anything more exciting than being on that 60-foot speedboat on a pitch-dark night with the Mounties' cutters in hot pursuit and powerful searchlights vainly attempting to penetrate our smokescreen, which lay flat on the calm waters of Northumberland Strait. Only a bullet could have caught us that night. Our boat was the finest and fastest rum runner ever to work on this coast, and I was the only Canadian to be on her crew.
Wrote Hugh Corkum, a Prohibition-era rum runner, about the shootout at Buctouche when the RCMP tried to capture the famous liquor smuggling ship he was aboard, called the Liberty. The Liberty was powered by three airplane engines and was called the fastest ship on the Atlantic seaboard. This is the first of a three-episode Backyard History podcast special called the Liberty on the Rocks trilogy. This first episode's telling the story of the Mounties trying to capture the Liberty in New Brunswick. Part two is going to be called Initiation of a Lunenburg Rum Runner. And we'll go back to when Hugh Corkum first got involved in rum running at the age of only 15 years old. And then for the third part, we're going to PEI for the dramatic conclusion to Liberty on the Rocks called Captured in Charlottetown.
You're listening to Backyard History, the hidden stories that happened in your own backyard. The podcast version of the weekly history column running in newspapers across the Maritimes, with your host and author, Andrew McLean.
In the heart of an inky black night, with the moon shrouded in a sinister veil, a vessel stealthily navigates through the treacherous waters off the coast of Buctouche, New Brunswick. That ship, named the Liberty, was laden down with a load of very valuable and very illegal alcohol. It was then the depths of the Great Depression, and many Maritimers had to turn to smuggling illegal booze from European ships onto the coasts of Canada. From there, the booze would be moved to the United States, where it would sell for enormous sums of desperately needed money. Aboard the Liberty was Hugh Corkum, the ship's wireless operator, who would later write a book about his experiences as a rum runner called On Both Sides of the Law. In that book, he wrote about what he called the Buctouche Incident.
I received my orders via wireless radio to pick up 300 kegs of rum from the mothership for a drop near Buctouche, New Brunswick. Buctouche, in the Northumberland Strait, was considered quite risky because we had to go so far inside the limit. There weren't enough dark hours to cover the distance in safety. We couldn't use the high speed, which could be heard for miles on the calm waters of the strait. The mothership was way off the coast, between Prince Edward Island and the Magdalen Islands, to keep clear of patrol boats and the shipping lanes as much as possible. We were always on alert for approaching boats and ships, and especially for the Mounties' cutters. It was no problem to keep clear of anything afloat at our speeds. If anything would appear, we'd start up, steam away a few miles. But this time, our destination was far up the strait and inside the limit as far as a boat could go. It was risky, because the weather was fine. We had a long trip ahead of us. Our appointed arrival time was midnight.
The feared cutters that the crew of the Liberty were watching out for belonged to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Hugh Corkum wrote that
the RCMP were more efficient, faster cutters, more familiarity with our methods of operations than before. Rum running on the Canadian Atlantic seaboard was really a game of cat and mouse, and the RCMP were the good guys, and we, of course, were the villains.
The year was 1937, and on the surface, 1937 seems like an awfully odd time to be smuggling illegal alcohol into New Brunswick. You see, Prohibition was long over and done with, both in that province and in Hugh Corkum's home province of Nova Scotia by then. Alcohol had been legalized again, and it had been for sale in government-owned liquor stores for a full decade by that point. However,
in 1935-36, rum running on the eastern Canadian seaboard was really at its peak.
Just because it was legal in the Maritimes certainly didn't mean that the liquor smuggling had stopped. The buyers of the illegal booze were a mixed bag, including wealthy local Maritimers who enjoyed the better selection and cheaper prices the bootleggers offered. Much of the smuggled liquor was going to the United States, though, which was considerably behind Canada in terms of legalizing alcohol. Although the United States had technically repealed prohibition and made alcohol legal in 1933, they were going about it rather chaotically. At first, the only alcohol that could be sold was this curious, very low percentage light beer. Not only that, but many whole states and individual counties within those states still restricted or even completely banned booze. This meant, for rum runners like Hugh Corkum, smuggling alcohol into America was every bit as lucrative as ever. Another reason that rum running was more popular than ever was because suddenly more people were willing to do it. Shortly after alcohol was legalized, in 1927 in New Brunswick, and 3 years later in 1930 in Nova Scotia, the entire global economy collapsed in the worst economic crisis in centuries, called the Great Depression. For most of the Maritimers who were involved in rum running, it was not only just a job, but it was a job of last resort. A good portion of the Maritimers who got involved in illegal liquor smuggling were far from those famous American gangsters like Al Capone. They were just ordinary farmers and fishermen who'd been forced to resort to illegal activities to survive after the economy collapsed. The terrifying thing about the Great Depression, though, wasn't that there was too little to go around. There weren't shortages of food or consumer goods. Actually, there was too much. Potatoes rotted in the ground in PEI. Wheat fields out west were burned because there were too many crops that nobody was buying. Houses and apartments stood empty. There was too much to go around, except money and jobs. If this wasn't weird enough, if you actually did have a job, then life in the Great Depression was actually pretty great. High-tech and brand new consumer goods were being manufactured. There was all sorts of new and exciting distractions like radio, movies, cars. Alcohol was legal again at the end of the 20s. Dance halls were popular and attitudes towards sex were more open than ever before. Prices of goods were at record lows. The costs of key things like rent went way down. Eggs sold for just 5 cents a dozen. A whole chicken went for 25 cents. Butter cost 20 cents a pound. A pair of jeans cost about a dollar. A nice new pair of shoes would be about $3.50. A brand new suit at Tip Top Tailors would set you back $21.50. For children, 5 packs of chewing gum could be got for a nickel, and candy bars were 2 for a penny. Maybe those prices seem pretty good, but not in comparison to income. In 1929, right before the stock market crashed and a decade-long Great Depression kicked off, the average New Brunswicker was making only $292 a year. In the depths of the Depression, New Brunswickers' average income fell to only $185 a year. And that was if they had a job at all. The unemployment rate hit a staggering 40% in the Maritimes. So it wasn't that Maritimers wanted to get involved in illegal smuggling. It was that they had to break the law to survive. And also, the money that could be made off rum running was no comparison to what could be made legally back then. Simply being a crewman on one of those small cutters like the Liberty smuggling liquor into the United States from Canada, and this is just for a beginner sailor, not even for the captain, could make about $250 for a single successful trip. That's more than an average Maritimer's salary for a year on one trip. The captains of the ships might be paid around $400 a month. This money had a tendency to get shared around local communities fairly generously too, making an average Maritimer actually pretty supportive of the rum runners, even if what they were doing was illegal. And they were not particularly inclined to help out the rum runners' arch nemesis, the Mounties. When I was a kid, I remember my grandfather telling me stories about how he would watch a game of cat and mouse between the rum runners and the Mounties up in Glenlevet on New Brunswick's North Shore when he was a young boy. He'd talk about the neighbors on the farms nearby, not his family of course, who would conveniently forget their barn doors open, and then they would just not notice headlights in the night and cars driving into their barns to hide out and rest for the evening. Then the next day, those farmers would go to their barns and they'd find them empty. Except for a crisp new $5 bill, which mysteriously appeared overnight. It's an impressive sum of money for a farmer on the North Shore during the Great Depression, and all they had to do was forget the barn door open and have a rum runner hide in their barn for the night. Hugh Corkum, who was aboard the Liberty, had been involved in the illegal liquor trade since he was only 15 years old, when he had dropped out of school to take up rum running in order to feed his family a decade earlier in 1927. However, at the same time, he hadn't been entirely comfortable with it. His goal was always to save up money and then get out of the rum running business. It took him only 2 years to save up enough money to not only put his three younger sisters through school, but to quit rum running and go to college in America. There he got a degree in the then new and exciting world of wireless radio communication. Seemed like he had a bright future ahead of him when he graduated, but then the stock market crashed, imploding the entire global economy, and the Great Depression set in. Freshly graduated Hugh Corkum found that any job that opened up would receive literally hundreds upon hundreds of job applications. Whatever job he applied for would reject him because there were vastly more experienced candidates available from the multitude of unemployed. He wrote in his memoirs,
"I completed my course in March, left for Toronto to seek my fortune. The answer was always, I'm sorry. They told me they were closing up stations all across Canada, laying off men, and that was a great disappointment. I was getting short of money. Being a country boy at heart, my decision was to come back to my roots in Lunenburg. I came home. Thought I'd go rum running, because of the money. I always look for the job with the most money and the highest risk."
By 1937, as the Liberty made its way towards Bucktouche that night, rum running had become quite sophisticated. This was certainly true of the Liberty herself. She was a specially constructed, custom-made 60-foot ship with six crew members aboard. The Liberty had been built for speed. She had three airplane engines in her. She also had a wireless communication set on board, a new and high-tech, cutting-edge piece of equipment at the time. Hugh Corkum, who had gone to college to study wireless, had found himself to be in high demand on rum-running ships for this specific expertise. That night, he was using that wireless radio to coordinate the Liberty's meetup with people on the shores near Bucktouche, who would be buying and unloading the cargo of booze. Hugh Corkum wrote in his later memoirs that it was as they were headed towards their rendezvous with the mothership that things started to go wrong.
"As it was getting closer to dusk, and we were approaching the 12-mile international waters limit, a plane flew very low overhead. In fact, it was so low that those of us on the deck ducked. When they waved for us to get out, we identified it as a police plane. They circled us three times, waving frantically. Captain Ducat continued on our course. I told him they didn't know exactly where we were heading, but they knew where we were bound to land, a cargo somewhere nearby, and every policeman in New Brunswick would be on a sharp lookout for us. I expected machine gun or rifle fire from the plane, if only to warn us, but none came. They finally flew away in the direction of Charlottetown, and we altered our course more directly towards our destination. I'm sure they reported our position, size, and course."
Hugh Corkum and the Liberty were racing through the darkness that night towards a desolate patch of coast outside of Bucktouche, which is in Kent County. In Kent County, the rum-running operations were controlled by ferociously independent local farmers and fishermen. None of the big gangs could make any headway into getting the locals to cooperate with them. Not the local maritime gangs, like Joe Walnut's Madawaska mob, who we covered in two other episodes, and certainly not the big American gangs, like Al Capone's. You've probably heard how Al Capone's American rum-running operation was ultimately busted, not for any of his murders or his smuggling or any of his other violent crimes, but for tax evasion. The RCMP actually tried a similar thing with these farmers and fishermen of Kent County. They launched detailed audits of these farmers' income, finding that there was No way that they could be making as much money as they were on their meager incomes from their rocky and unproductive farms, or for fishing. The Mounties audits identified that there was a lot of money flowing into Kent County, and that the number one thing it was being spent on wasn't anything like fast cars and fancy jewelry. It was toilets. In a time where most Maritimers didn't have indoor plumbing or running water, the smugglers of Kent County weren't spending their windfalls on luxuries, but on basics. While the rum runners were certainly breaking the law, most of them weren't exactly greedy criminal masterminds. They were average farmers and fishermen who were doing what they had to provide for their families those most basic of amenities: food, shelter, and yes, toilets. Hugh Corkum was aboard the Liberty approaching the coasts of Kent County to meet up with some of those local farmers turned illegal liquor smugglers. He wrote that as they approached Kent County,
"The only thing in our favor was that it was very dark. But even that had its bad points, because searchlights could penetrate the darkness, and there was a greater possibility of surprise. The Cutters had some powerful searchlights. Put it in perspective, I would say we were looking for trouble. We were vulnerable, because it was hard for us to spot a hull that had no lights before being too close for safety. The police had to know we were on our way, and they had plenty of time to set a nice trap for us. I visualized police on their boats, patiently waiting with their hands on their searchlights and rifles. Cook and I were on lookout. There were some bright lights on the land about 2 miles ahead. I thought I saw a black object blot out several of the shore lights. I asked the cook to look. He said yes, that could be a Cutter. Whatever it was, it had no lights on. I told the captain. He immediately turned the boat around, went back out a mile, and then traveled down the coast a distance before turning toward the shore again. We went slowly, very slowly. When we were about 1 mile offshore from our drop, lo and behold, looming right ahead of us was another Cutter. I immediately said, 'Let's get the hell out of here. I saw men running around on her deck. It was a trap.'
Fortunately for him, though, the Liberty was a specially built, custom-made ship that had been constructed especially for rum running. It was not only built for speed, with its 3 airplane engines, but it also had some unique defensive features. It boasted several armored plates in its hull, and it also had a smoke screen that, when turned on, would emit a massive cloud of black smoke that could cover the area and obscure the vision of the pursuing Mountie Cutters.
And in no time flat, we were on our way out at full speed and with smoke screen coming out of our manifold. Within 10 seconds, we were hitting 38 knots or more. They turned on a searchlight, but our smokescreen obliterated it completely. We still had to go past the other Cutter, which was about 3/4 of a mile outside of us. She also put on her searchlight on us when we got close. She was on our starboard side. We turned 90 degrees to port, and our smokescreen did a good job of blanking her out. It was quite a sight, watching the reflection of the searchlights trying to penetrate the heavy smokescreen. Shots were fired at us by both Cutters at point-blank range. We didn't hear a thing. We saw no evidence of the Cutters, who were in hot pursuit thanks to our very efficient smokescreen. Had they been on their toes, we never would have been able to escape, and they could have shot us right out of the water.
After they escaped and reached the safety of the high seas, far out of the reach of the Mounties' Cutters, Hugh Corkum reflected on what happened. Once he thought about it, he deduced that someone had betrayed the Liberty and had told the Mounties where the drop point was, and that the cops had been there all along, lying in wait.
I never had any doubt in my mind that we were set up that night. We were extremely lucky to get out of that trap.
He wasn't sure they were betrayed, though, and he admitted that rum runners were actually deeply paranoid about spies working for the Mounties.
Our worst fear were the squealers. They'd gathered a few informers and were slowly and quietly infiltrating our operation. That was why our crew, especially on our boat, had to be well-picked, hand-screened, and well-screened. We on the rum runners had much to lose. We were hunted at all times. We had to be on guard at all times, not only in what we did, but also what we said around public places, such as hotels and bar rooms. There were spies even in the woodwork.
Thinking about the high-speed chase and being shot at by the police in Bucktouche, he wrote,
"It was really a wild night. This spectacular incident. It must have been heard and witnessed by many on the shore to see the Liberty flying along on a dark, calm night at 38 knots, with a full smokescreen, two cutters in hot pursuit, and some live ammunition being thrown at us for good measure. Must have been a sight to behold. The lesson we learned that night was never to use our full engine power unless it was absolutely necessary. When we did, the Liberty was 60 feet of dynamite. They really did not know how to deal with a fast boat of our class, and we escaped from right under their noses. Only a bullet could have caught us that night. We were lucky there were no trigger-happy boys on the cutters, so we lived to see another day. But I believe the RCMP Marine section also learned a lesson that night. They were learning fast about our ways, and I could feel the noose getting tighter."
Stay tuned for part two of the Liberty on the Rocks trilogy, where we look at how teenage Hugh Corkum dropped out of school in Nova Scotia to become a rum runner, and how he managed to first meet the fastest rum running ship of them all, the Liberty.
That was Backyard History with your host, Andrew McLean. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for another hidden story that happened in your own backyard.
Hugh Corkum, voiced by Jordan Batstone.
Produced by Jordan Lozier.